Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour. It is June 12, 2014. A few topics tonight, and then interestingly enough, I got some very positive feedback from listeners regarding last week's show where I was talking about some the origins of Mayan and Aztec cities. So they requested that I continue with that topic just a little bit more because I was kind of cut off in mid-breath by the end of the show, which often happens. I just, you know, it's like running a race and you hit the end of the finish line and you're still running. That's what happened last week. So anyway, a few quick announcements first. This sent in by a listener, a reference to an article in which physicists, that magic word, like people that know everything in the world, supposedly, physicists plan to wipe out the Van Allen Belt. Now, this is a bizarre, bizarre story, and this is not the first time people have suggested this, but I find it comical in the article how they refer to the Apollo astronauts. Not a lot of comment, but if it wasn't a problem for the astronauts and all of them, Apollo astronauts, if all of them lived to a ripe old age without any, you know, hint of problems, then why is it a problem? Well, it's these contradictions keep popping up. And the actual reality is that the Van Allen belts are a real problem. And let me explain just fundamentally what the problem is. The Van Allen belts are a number. Now there are three total that have been discovered. Two were discovered a very long time ago. But back just a short while ago, it was discovered that there was a third belt. Now, these probably come and go, wax and wane with the input and various factors from the sun. But basically, they are high-energy electrons and protons counter-rotating in belts. And these kind of look like just narrow donuts surrounding Earth. They reach down as far as about 500 miles above the Earth's surface, so they are relatively close to Earth. There's a story about the shuttle astronauts who went up, and they decided to put them into a little bit higher orbit. Now, remember that since the so-called Apollo lunar landing, the alleged lunar landing, back in the late 60s, that no human has ventured outside of low Earth orbit. Now, if it were no big deal, well, why not just kick them out there all the time? But on one shuttle mission, they did move them out a little bit higher, a number of hundreds of miles, and by the way, the shuttle typical orbit is very close to the Earth, maybe 128 miles. 60 miles marks the edge of what they call vacuum space. That's where the Earth's atmosphere really thins out to almost nothing. So that's where you basically leave the Earth's atmosphere. If you were within that region, you would start to experience drag on your spacecraft. The atmosphere would be thick enough where you would soon start to fall back into the Earth's atmosphere. So you want to keep any orbiting spacecraft well outside of that region. So anyway, on one shuttle mission, they sent the shuttle nauts up a bit above the Earth's the normal low Earth orbit. And lo and behold, their eyebrows started to glow. And why would their eyebrows glow? Well, what's happening is the voltage that's created around the spacecraft by being in the non-uniform electric field was sufficient, a high voltage developed basically, and they were electrically discharging, right inside of the space shuttle compartment, the human containment portion of the space shuttle. And so their eyebrows started to glow. They started to feel funny tingling sensations, and so they quickly brought them back down, and that's the first and the last time since the alleged Apollo astronauts flew allegedly through the Van Allen belts. But like I say, in this article, I'll just reference it. This was from Science, an article written by Graham Templeton, February 27, 2014, the title, Physicists Plan to Wipe Out Earth's Van Allen Belts. And it was this was from actually geek.com, the webpage geek.com. But anyway, I just want to read a couple passages here because this is so incredibly bizarre. A prominent group of physicists want the Van Allen belts dead. It says it's understandable given the frustration these areas of space can cause to modern astrophysicists. If you want to launch a satellite or a telescope, let alone a human being, the Van Allen The Van Allen belts will be a painful or thorn in your side. So, you know, once again, why wasn't it a problem back in the Apollo days? You know, you had, you know, a dozen so-called Apollo nuts going up to the moon, coming back. They all lived happily ever after, no problem. And nobody ever went up into the Van Allen belts again. But when I worked with Russian scientists back in the mid-90s, they laughed at the Apollo program, and they said these people never went to the moon. And the reason is because they, long before the Apollo program ever got its feet under itself, the Russians had sent a man to the moon. And so they came back very much French fried by going through the Van Allen belts. They were very dead, let's put it that way. The high energy particles hit the metal in the spacecraft. They turn into X-rays. These are relativistic particles. This is like the best linear accelerator that man or money could buy in outer space. And so anyway, those high-energy particles hit the metal in the spacecraft, turn into X-rays, and those X-rays are, it's like an X-ray microwave oven. Now, a microwave oven cooks on the principle that microwaves are absorbed in water. So if you put food into a microwave oven, the water absorbs the microwaves and heats up very quickly. That's the principle of a microwave oven. Well, imagine an X-ray oven in which instead of microwaves, you have X-rays. Basically, French fried by X-rays. That's like going into your friendly local hospital to get an X-ray, and they don't just do a little flash for a brief second or part of a second. They just leave it on, and you sit there for hours baking in X-rays. No, it's going to French fry you. Heat up your cells, and you're going to be very dead very soon. So anyway, I find it kind of comical, and I've mentioned this many times before in my comments, and it's one of the more commonly referred to issues when people talk about the question of NASA going to the moon back in the 60s and 70s with the Apollo program. How on earth did they get through the Van Allen belts, and how did they manage, and why wasn't it a problem then? There's an entire program at NASA called Living with a Star, where they have thousands of physicists working on exactly that. How on earth do you get through the Van Allen belts without any damage to your equipment or to your people? More the people. If you have a moon, man to Mars, man to the moon, man to anything, even above higher than low Earth orbit, you need to deal with this issue. And so, like I say, the one time they did send somebody up there, their eyebrows literally started to glow, and they brought them back down. And of course, nobody ever has talked about the after effects of those people. So obviously a major contradiction, but as with NASA living up to its name, never a straight answer, Anyway, I won't go and belabor this particular topic any longer, but I think it's important to note that this major contradiction exists in the scientific world, and of course nobody's talking about it. But the article that people, scientists, are actually proposing to destroy a very important factor in Earth's magnetic environment. Now, let me explain briefly how Earth's magnetic field works. If you hold a compass in your hand, like a Boy Scout compass, and you determine north, that north is a reading. That's the compass. That's a magnetic piece of magnetic material on the tip of that compass needle, which wants to move into a northerly direction, so that the needle points to north. It is based on the Earth's local magnetic field, which is made up of many factors. In fact, during a solar storm, you can watch your little Boy Scout compass moving. Set it on a table, and you can actually see it moving back and forth as the solar storm proceeds. And so anyway, so part of this, is, of course, is due to the magnetic field that's locked into the Earth's core, mainly in nickel and in iron. If you're in northern Minnesota, up in the woods, a compass is not going to do you much good because the magnetic field lines are all over the place. They vary wildly depending on your local position. And so anyway, the magnetic field, your local magnetic field, is made up of that magnetic field, the permanent magnetic field in the surface, the crust, the mantle of the Earth. There is also a contribution from some current activity, current loops that are a little bit lower in the Earth's magma, just a little bit below the crust and the mantle. But then also you have the ionosphere. You have three major electrical current contributions from the ionosphere. One is the easterly flowing jet streams that are actually in the atmosphere. They flow at mid-latitudes in the easterly direction, one that typically is over North America or Europe or Russia. And it's kind of like a snaking pattern. You can see drawings of these in my weather book and my other books. And then around the equator, going in the westerly direction, is an electron current, which is very well defined and very narrow and very linear. In other words, it's not snaking. It pretty much goes in a linear fashion around the equator. They create a coupled magnetic field, which is the next layer up. Outside of Earth's atmosphere, the next layer of coupled magnetic fields, plasma magnetic field, are the Van Allen belts. That's the next layer, which then couples to the plasma magnetic field, which is way out. It's about on the nose, on the sunward side of Earth. It's about 35,000 miles out on the sunward side. On the sides of the Earth, it can vary. It can vary anywhere to very close to the Earth to very far, depending on the magnetic field. And then the magnetic field lines drape way back from Earth, as much as a million miles sometimes. And so anyway, all of these magnetic fields are coupled together. So it would be insane to take out one of the pieces of these magnetic fields. And these scientists, in their complete ignorance, say that, oh, the Van Allen belts aren't necessary. There's no need for them. We don't see any need for them, they say. So we can destroy them at will, and gee, nothing will happen. That would be like a 18th century doctor looking at a kidney and going, well, doggone, I don't see any use for that kidney. Why don't we just cut them out of everybody? Or how about lungs? You know, they really weren't too sure why lungs were necessary, or possibly even your heart. Let's just cut it out. It's not necessary. We don't see why this is necessary. And so that's their rationale. They don't see why it's necessary, therefore it must not be necessary, therefore let's eliminate it. And they are actually hoping to do this. So it's absolute insanity. People have nothing better to do I suggest they go back into their office and play with something else, possibly some body parts, I don't know. But don't play with the Van Allen belts. Possibly take their brains out and play with them. We could do a study on physicists' brains, take them out and play with those. But don't play with the Van Allen belt. It's just absolutely insane. Okay, enough said about that. But just absolute insanity. A quick comment about a couple energy topics here. T. Boone Pickens in the news. The guy's got too much money and too much time on his hands. Wants to consolidate. Now, he has invested heavily in wind farms. And they say at times these wind farms can produce up to 7% of the Southwest, the American Southwest energy requirements. But remember that they always quote the maximum. On other days, they don't contribute any factor. And so the unfortunate part is that the suppliers, the people who run the coal, the nuclear, and sometimes natural gas energy systems, typically the natural gas are the backup systems that'll run the big generators that contribute part of the energy load. They have to adjust the load every 5 minutes, and this is done manually. So if you turn on your, you know, everybody gets home at 5 in the afternoon, turns on their air conditioners, that power has to be manually adjusted at the source, at the generating plants. And they do this every 5 minutes to keep the energy flowing and keep the voltage up and keep the proper amount of current, keep the power going out on those high voltage lines and deliver it to the homes. What they're suggesting, which is actually a good concept, is to have all of this coordinated across a 5-state region. And so this is being done, unfortunately, by a guy with a lot of money, T. Boone Pickens. He has a $28 billion investment in what they call renewable energy. This would be good if you didn't have it in the hands of a guy who also owns most of the water rights throughout the American Southwest and Texas. Has purchased land on top of the Oglala Reservoir, and isn't it odd that he can withdraw all of the water he wants from the Oglala Reservoir, yet a farmer up in Oregon was sued and sent to jail for collecting rainwater in his pond. You know, the dichotomy here between the rich and the average guy on the street is just, it's very bizarre, and it's even more bizarre. By the way, this has spawned me into defining something I call illegal laws. And so as citizens, we have to just say there are a series of laws that are simply illegal. I mean, starting from the IRS, starting from laws that prevent citizens from collecting rainwater, carbon tax. These are simply illegal laws. They should have never been voted in. Whoever did it should be arrested and put in prison. But the fact is that citizens have to take a stand, and this is, you know, just another case where a guy named T. Boone Pickens has just too much monopoly on this. All of his wealth should be divided up amongst smaller entities, and he should be just labeled simply a monopoly in regards to water, in regards to electricity, and broken up into smaller pieces where individuals have the ability to profit, not just one person. And that also takes away the ability of one person to control and then jack the prices up once that control is in place. And remember, that's the goal, the idea that energy should be owned. Remember that we never did need electric. We never did need coal, nuclear, or oil in the energy scheme of things. We never needed any of that. Imagine what the world would be like today if we simply used energy, first of all, within our means, industry, which mainly produces a lot of useless stuff. We don't need all the stuff that's being produced today. In fact, that might be an interesting experiment, is simply stop buying stuff. We don't need all the stuff that's being produced today. Just live a simple lifestyle, cut down on what you purchase, save your money, buy a house that's well within your means, pay it off within a couple years, stop this cycle of bank loans and reselling houses, moving every couple years, and concentrate on family life. Just eating good food, have a garden that produces your food. Remember that your three major expenses in life today are home, transportation, which means automobile, and gas, including the gas. You have to add that in, of course. And, of course, the state-mandated insurance. But food. Food is becoming a major expense in modern life. Those three items, if you can eliminate the cost of those, you can't eliminate them. You need shelter, you need transportation, and you need food. But if you can eliminate the cost of those, then you can live relatively inexpensively. And so anyway, that's something, my lesson, Economics 101 lesson for the day. Live inexpensively. Get away from, expensive housing. Get away from expensive automobiles. You can drive a nice car, just don't have that monthly payment. And then don't go to a 40-hour week job where you have to drive and pay all the money that is required. You know, live in an area where taxation and utilities, especially water, are low. And all of a sudden, you're living a lifestyle very much happier than you were before. You're not paying everybody on the planet, and so your cost of living is down. So that's a long-term program to eliminate the expenses of those items: shelter, transportation, and food. And also coming up very soon, and actually upon us, is the cost of water. You have to be able to be your own source of fresh, clean water. And a lot of people, I've noticed, if you go to states where there's especially bad water, say Florida or, well, just about all 50 states, there's very few places anymore that have clean, fresh water. But if you look at, say, a gravity feed water filter. First of all, it's going to work when the electric and the city water goes off, so you're still going to have fresh water, but no more bottled water. It drives me crazy when I see people buying bottled water. And, speaking of bottled water, this is a good one. You know, we've had some serious hot weather lately. So I go out to a convenience store, and I quick have to run in to get something. And here are cases and cases of clear, those thin little plastic bottles. You know how they wrap them in like a shrink wrap and stack them. Sitting outside this convenience store, baking in the sun. So this is before people would buy them. Now, that sun is going to drive the chemicals in that plastic right into the water, so everybody that buys that water is going to get a good dose of carcinogenic water with all that chemical. It's just insane, but that's how, you know, people have no clue. This stacks and cases, pallets of those, like, 1 liter clear little thin wall plastic bottles, cases of them stacked out on the sunward side of this convenience store. I mean, it's just, I couldn't believe it. I thought, man, everybody that drinks that is going to get cancer. And they think they're buying healthy, fresh water. Absolutely incredible. So don't use bottled water. 99% of the time it's just put in right from the tap or from a Lake Superior or Lake Michigan. Nestles is in Lake Michigan. Coca-Cola is in Lake Superior. Just putting direct from the lake right into bottles, no filtering. They say it's filtered, but it's 99% of the time it's not. And if they can sell it quickly enough, it doesn't develop bacteria. And 50 billion of those bottles sold worldwide every year. Absolute ecological disaster. Don't buy any more bottled water, please. If you're a listener and you respect your planet, if you respect yourself, your kids, your environment, do not buy any more bottled water. I sell very high-end stainless steel water bottles. They're expensive, but it's the only water bottle you'll ever have to purchase. I don't like aluminum ones. I won't go into the laundry list of problems with aluminum water bottles, the cheapies. The stainless steel ones, they're going to be here in 100 years. But I would not personally buy plastic water bottles any more than I drink out of a thin plastic disposable water bottle. Okay, on to the next topic. Obama is shutting down coal plants, and the majority of these will be shut down January 1st, 2015. And so I have opinions about that, but the biggest opinion I have is that we never needed any of these in the first place. But it's going to cause a real shortage. It's going to cause a problem because the remaining power facilities only can produce about 70% of the country's needs. And so, you know, without a plan to just, that's what you've got, a president that doesn't know anything. But part of these plans are, you know, they're part of a bigger plan. When they, just like the California contrived water drought, once the deficiency gets in there, then the control elements can come online, starting to control the water situation, starting to control the energy situation, raising prices, driving the American public further into debt. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit here, talking about a bit of weather manipulation. Now, this is the same issue that we saw a number of weeks ago when, remember, I talked about a storm center, which just centered on Iowa, and the arms of that storm system covered the American South all the way from Oklahoma and Texas, all the way across. That's the one that kept bombing Pensacola, Florida, just horrendous amounts of rain. And then the next wave would come through of tornadoes. And the center of the storm just sat there on Iowa for 4 days straight. Well, we have a similar situation now in the American Southland. And let me see, I'll get the epicenter for this storm. It's right over the state of, let's say Jefferson City, Missouri. That's about the epicenter of this storm system. And for days now, it has just sat there spinning. And today, Tuesday, first of all, Monday and Tuesday, we had waves of these storm systems. It's the southern arm of like a hurricane system, but over land, I call it a himicane, that is moving in across Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, up into Tennessee, into the Carolinas, Virginia, etc. But then these storms move out into the Atlantic and the next wave starts. So this, like I say, this storm system just sitting over around Jefferson, Missouri. And with the wave after wave after wave, this southern arm swinging around over those southern states. So another very obvious weather manipulated situation. And then what they can do is enhance these arms with laser satellites or with activating with HAARP or with chemtrails spraying to activate these. So these are experiments. These are going on right now. Why they're doing this, who knows? But it's obviously manipulated weather systems moving through once again the American Southland. And here was an interesting article sent in by a listener that Lake Superior, the largest lake in the world, has floating icebergs still left over this observed this past week. And this gets a little bit interesting just in the article itself. When I first looked up the article from the reference sent in by a listener, there was the article, Big as Life, talking about the DNR, the Department of Natural Resource, observing icebergs. on Lake Superior. And remember that the last two winters up in that region were just the most severe in history. The one last year, the 2013 end of winter, was unbelievable. Remember that they had 55 inches of snow. They had literally a world record of snow in 1 month, in the month of April, up in that region of the United States, up in northern Minnesota, actually. 55 inches of snow in April. Hello, Donner Party. But this year was even worse. And so anyway, this up there, here we are pushing mid-June, still icebergs floating in Lake Superior. And what's interesting about this article is when I first pulled it up on a, let's see, I think it was probably Tuesday, this past Tuesday, then the article disappeared. That's part of that web cleansing activity. Remember, we can only say things that are kosher with the paradigm that wants to be pushed onto the public. Floating icebergs on Lake Superior in June is not one of them. So it was cleansed because it doesn't go along with the global climate change. They're still trying to edge on this idea of global climate warming, even though we are cooling. And remember, a couple weeks ago, I concentrated on rapid climate change. The fact that, for example, Antarctica had the minimal ice pack in history a number of years ago, and then just this past winter had the largest ice pack in history. So that's the southern hemisphere, Antarctica. And here we have an article regarding the northern hemisphere. You might think, well, maybe there's colder one area, but then compensating another part of the world would be warmer. But Lake Superior is in the northern hemisphere, obviously much colder in the northern hemisphere. So rapid climate change is not something they want the public to know about, because clearly that's not being caused by you driving your SUV up and down the road, if you understand what I'm saying. So they can't really promote this idea of rapid climate change. They want to, if it's caused by you driving your SUV up and down the road, then it has to be slow and steady and constant, at least in the single direction. So my whole talk about rapid climate change was to point out that there is no such thing as climate. The term climate is a misnomer. It's a misguided term. Back in the days of the dinosaurs, you could have climate for a million-year period when things didn't change. You had a very thick canopy atmosphere of Earth, but a comet came by, relieved Earth of its atmosphere. Obviously, there was some other activity going on at that time. It's hard to say exactly what happened, but clearly Earth's atmosphere changed drastically, just like Mars lost its atmosphere when the comet Venus came by a number of thousands of years ago. This was witnessed worldwide. The entire story that Velikovsky passes down, and that's why the Velikovsky story is so absolutely important. It doesn't just talk about Earth, it talks about Jupiter being affected, it talks about Mars being affected, it talks about Earth being affected by the same comet. So at any rate, very important to analyze these issues, you know, for what they're worth historically, etc. As many of you know, the state of Vermont passed an anti-GMO labeling law. And, of course, this is against a lot of opposition from large companies such as Monsanto. However, 33 states have been conned or somehow bribed, whatever, into passing laws which state that the voters cannot vote on anti-GMO labeling laws. This is the most draconian, bizarre twist to Republican government and to republic style of government, not Republican, not to be confused with the Republican Party, but the concept of democracy where people vote and have a say in what goes on. In the two counties in Oregon, as I announced a week or two ago, it was overwhelming vote against GMOs. In fact, there, like many other counties in the United States, they have completely banned anything GMO. So when the public is allowed to decide, the clear vote is against GMO, GMO labeling, etc. So how could states pass laws that prevent voters from voting on this issue? It's so beyond bizarre. Like I say, there are simply what we have to call illegal laws that defy logic, that defy any reason, that defy the ability of the public to decide for themselves what should go on. So you simply have to classify these as illegal laws, and they're not to be obeyed, not to be followed, not to be given any sort of honorarium. But of course, they enforce these by goon control, where they send out the goons, and of course the people are starting to resist this. The Bundy Ranch incident about a month ago now in out west, simply the people are picking up guns and telling the government to get out. I heard a very good story about, I won't say exactly where this was, but it was a county down south in one of the southeastern states, down with some of the good old boys. Some of the IRS came in, decided they were going to audit a city. Well, I guess the boys got together, put them in a car, drove them to the county line, and told them don't come back in a serious, more than serious manner. So at any rate, this is happening all over. The people have just had enough, and there's no other way to deal with it. If you look at other revolutions, the French Revolution, the storming of the Bastille, people just hit a breaking point, and that's it. And I hope that happens in this country sooner than later. Because the sooner it happens, the less prepared the official leaders will be. And really, this has to happen on a local level also, because it's at the local level where all of this begins. Unfortunately, if you make an assumption that political leaders somehow have your best interest in mind, 99% of the time, that's simply not the case. Okay, so I'm going to turn to the main science topic, talking a little bit about how old things are. And last week, I do want to conclude what I was talking about last week about Mayan and Aztec archaeology. So let's go back and just review the scenario. Over a period of clearly many thousands of years prior to the Noah flood, Earth had a serious worldwide population, and they were doing what the human race is doing now, basically a virus on the Earth. And remember the story of Cain and Abel and the devastation, the population that evolved from that dichotomy of personalities, so-called human personalities. And once again, the Noah movie with Russell Crowe does a great job of depicting that, the growth of the virus, the human virus side of the human personality. And it just seems that there's a real polarity in the human psyche. One wants to destroy, one wants to use beyond all reasonable measure. The other polar type of human wants to conserve, live within their means, be happy, live with their family, etc., and just take it easy. And it seems like the other pole, the negative pole, always seems to get into power. They seem to love to destroy. They can't stand to see the other group sitting around enjoying life and taking it easy. They have to destroy. They have to overuse resources. They have to dominate. They have to get everything for them. The T-Boone Pickens, you know, enough is never enough. The people, you know, it's just a dichotomy. And so before Noah, the world was highly populated, and it was a devastation for the world. And so when Noah packed up his bags, put it in the ark, and put all the animals in the ark, it was, you know, the world had finally hit its peak of environmental abuse. And the story is that God destroyed the world with a flood. Well, of course, the flood was 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain, and this rain came from above. It came from outer space. And so clearly at that point we had passed through the tail of a comet for that period of time, 40 days and 40 nights of torrential rain. So this was a large comet. The Earth, basically the ocean levels rose, and when the water cleared, land emerged again. But imagine like the kind of rain that hit Pensacola, Florida about a month ago. 6 inches of rain in an hour, but 40 days and 40 nights of this. You know, the ocean levels rose by hundreds of feet. Okay, the descendants of Noah, eventually the Israelites, the ones that wanted to conserve the earth to live peacefully, the descendants finally made their way down to Noah, or to Moses. Now Moses, also being an Israelite, not to be confused with the Jews, and now this is a whole bit of history that has to be talked about here. How the Jews want to take over the concept that Moses was a Jew. He was not. He was an Israelite. And there's a big difference. It seems like there's one group of people who simply want to take over and claim that portions of history that don't belong to them. At any rate, the Israelites were in an economic bondage. They had been made into slaves economically, and you can see this happening again. It's happening today exactly as it happened prior to the days of Moses. So the second major earth event that took the earth to its knees was what I call the Venus event. That's the Moses event, when Venus, the comet, came through the solar system. It affected Jupiter. It affected Mars by relieving Mars of its atmosphere and oceans. And it affected Earth on two different occasions. We know this from the Mayan accounts, the modern Maya, and this is why I'm leading up to this, to put this into perspective. Okay, so the Moses event occurred, and that's when the original Maya, the ancient Maya, existed. They flourished, they had cities built, and the destruction was pretty much total. That's when the Earth's North Pole, the physical the physical North Pole of Earth, was in the state of, or in the province of Ontario, what we now call Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. The pole shifted because of the wrenching of the Earth's crust and mantle by the gravitational wave of the passing comet nucleus that eventually became the planet Venus. And that, by the way, is the mythological beginning of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky of the Mayans. Now, that legend carries all the way down into what we call the modern Mayans, but eventually all of the nations of the Earth struggled to rebuild the calendar because it had been changed drastically. Earth's orbit had changed. Earth's the spin rate of the Earth had changed. The direction of the physical North Pole of Earth had changed. Everything about Earth's orbit had changed. So obviously the calendar had to change. Probably the lunar orbit had changed. Many things had changed due to the passage of Venus. And by the way, That's one of the reasons I built my WeCalendar SunStar clock, is because with that single tablet of information, it records all of the data regarding Earth's orbit today. So if in 1,000, 10,000 years, archaeologists dig up that tablet, they will be able to not only put a baseline onto our history, but they will also be able to tell exactly where our orbit was based on the year 2012. So it's a very interesting aspect of that calendar. Not only can you rebuild the calendar, even if we lose time or calendar in the modern scenario without a pole shift, but after a pole shift, you could rebuild the calendar and determine the timeline of history that we are living under now. That's something that's totally missing from Mayan and Aztec archaeology, primarily Mayan. The Aztecs, remember, were kind of like the Romans related to the Greeks. The Romans copied a lot of stuff from the Greeks. They came afterwards, and the original developments were done by the Greeks in the Mideast. Egypt developed after the great Moses event. Remember that the history, Egypt was a colony of Atlantis at the time, and they were involved in a war with Greece, the ancient Greeks. And when the great catastrophe hit, the only ones that really survived in Greece were the sheep herders who lived up in the mountains. They survived in the caves. The Colburn is very specific about talking about the people who survived and the devastation, how the people were affected. The tremendous devastation on the populace and individuals. Okay, so let's go back to the Mayans over in what we call the Americas. They were devastated also. There were cities in Peru along the coast with 40 million people living there. They were washed clean. Not a potsherd remained. That's how devastating the floods were when they washed ashore. And remember now during the Moses event, these were tidal waves where the Earth's ocean sloshed back and forth over the land. Velikovsky shows that seashells are found up high in the Andes Mountains in Peru. That's how high the sloshing oceans got during that time, back in the Moses event, probably around 1500 BC, is about the time frame. Okay, that was the same situation with the ancient Mayans. They were totally devastated. Remember their North Pole, the North Pole of Earth, and the direction, the cardinal directions, north, east, south, and west, were in the direction of, north was in the direction, if you take a city like Chichen Itza, which is now rebuilt on the same grid work of the ancient cities that went under during the time of Moses, those ancient cities were built on a grid work that pointed north towards that North Pole, the ancient North Pole, that was around, like I say, in the state of, or the province of Ontario, just north of the state of Michigan. That's about where the old North Pole was. And, okay, let's take another scenario. When that North Pole shifted to where it is now, remember, it's just the crust and mantle of the Earth. It's not the entire Earth. How this exactly happens, I explain in detail in my pamphlet, Surviving Planet X Passage. The center pages are dedicated to how a pole shift works using a gravitational wave of a passing large celestial object. And it's just the crust and the mantle that shift, not the inner core of the Earth. Okay, so at any rate, the ancient Maya, after that Moses-Venus event, Quetzalcoatl in terms of the Peruvians, the Incas, the ancient Incas, the ancient Mayas, Quetzalcoatl was the deity. And some people may wonder, how could they carry on that tradition for thousands of years after the event? We do that same thing now. The Christian traditions are thousands of years old, and they're maintained today over thousands of years. So people do maintain these traditions. So the whole tradition of Quetzalcoatl and plumed serpent god, etc., but you understand, too, that modern archaeology doesn't acknowledge any of this. They don't recognize who Quetzalcoatl was or what he represented. He represented the comet Venus, but in modern archaeology, since they have to live in the same university as the astronomers, or the dominant vocal voice in all of academia today. The archaeologists have to follow suit. Now, that's something I saw firsthand when I was at Cornell. They had a fledgling beginning archaeoastronomy department. And I knew the various people in that because, of course, I was very interested in archaeology. I had done field work. I'd been in the field at archaeological digs around Latin America as these were being dug up out of the ground for the first time. And I recognized that these ancient cities had gone under during a time of severe stress. And so also the modern dating of many of these cities was incorrect. Many of these cities had been completely defunct for thousands of years, not hundreds of years. But that's a whole other story, how archaeologists, and I saw this unfortunately firsthand, they would dig something up out of the ground, and some archaeologists would go, oh, that's from the classic period. You know, 900 AD, and they, without any, it was just the archaeologist's opinion on site, and that was stamped and categorized that way, and that's the way it stayed thereafter. With no secondhand opinion, no reference, but it had had to sit and fit in with their dating structure, and it had no availability for the real event that happened, which was the Venus event, the time of Moses. Okay, so at any rate, let's fast forward up to what we call the modern Maya, from about 800 AD up to about 1300 AD. That's when the pinnacle of Mayan development occurred. That's when the great cities, the Palenques, the Chichen Itzas, the Uxmals, the other Tikal, you know, the other great cities of the Mayan empires, that's when they developed. And remember that they built first small temples, and then every 54 years they would build another layer. So that what you see today, if you go visit these cities, or if you visit them online or in a book, what you see today is many, many, many temples built one on top of the other. In the classic period, the 800 AD to 1300 AD, they were still around when the Spanish came at the end of the 1400s, early 1500s. The Mayans were still there, but remember, then they totally were lost, so to speak, after dying out, after the Spanish killed them off, what was left of them. They were rediscovered by Catherwood, and the very famous Catherwood drawings. If you want to see something amazing, I remember when I was in Mexico seeing the Catherwood prints, the actual original prints of Catherwood, great big prints where he did the artwork out in the jungle of the way they found the Mayan cities. Can you imagine back in the day of Catherwood? But remember, these were modern explorers that rediscovered, so-called the Mayan cities, and brought that information back to the public. But this is relative to the modern Maya from the 800 to 1300 AD epoch. They built, and they continued to build, the cities on the old gridworks of the cities that existed prior to the great devastation of the Venus event. By the way, if you want more information on this, I have a 2-CD set. It's called The Physics of Ancient Celestial Disasters, something that really everybody should listen to, and for sure all students, young kids, should be listening to these to understand the true history of the world. So when you go to your class, when you go to your history class in school, and the teacher tries to hand you the baloney that they're handing out to kids today, I would say challenge them. Challenge them and tell them what's in this book is baloney, and say it right out in class so the rest of the kids hear it. Because a lot of other kids are going to want to learn what the real story is also. I gave an example. It's in one of my books where I, in my astronomy classes, every semester at the university level, I would challenge the students to go back in history and put history back together and realize it's very easy to realize that what you're being taught in the history books could not possibly be true. The evolution of man from Mesopotamia and somehow within a few thousand years, all of the black races of Africa and the pygmy races of Africa and the Mayans of the Central America and the Europeans from Northern Europe, etc., that all of these races somehow developed in a couple thousand years out of one source from Mesopotamia. You know, it's so absurd. It is, I mean, that they crossed the land straits of the Bering Straits of Alaska from Russia to Alaska, following the herds. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all, yet this is the standard fare that's being taught in schools. So tell your friends in school, 3rd, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th grade, tell them that what they're teaching you here is a bunch of baloney. It couldn't possibly be true. And, it's just the way it is. So at any rate, what I wanted to do was kind of give an account of history and how these, especially relative to the Mayas, Incas, and Aztecs. Now, remember that the Aztecs, as I said, were almost like the Romans were relative to the Greeks. The Romans came much later. The Greeks were much earlier. In that respect, the Mayans were much earlier. The Aztecs were a much later development. The Toltecs were even earlier than the Aztecs. So what we see in Teotihuacan around Mexico City is one of the Montezuma, etc., all of that when the Spanish came was the pinnacle of Aztec social development, but they were much, much later in the geographical pyramid, in the geographical development of that area. So at any rate, I'm running up against the end of my hour again here. But like I say, I encourage kids to challenge their teachers and say, hey, what you're teaching us doesn't make any sense. There was a great flood, which you're not teaching us about, and it was one of the pinnacle events in all of the history of man. The Moses event was one of the primary events that developed what we call modern religion. A lot of the religious ceremonies, etc., are based on the results of that and the effect on modern man. At any rate, make sure you visit my webpage, jmccsci.com, short for jmccsci.com. The water filters, the books, etc., that helps us keep this show, this commercial-free show, going every week. And I know that these are products that are really top-of-the-line products that help you in your life. Once again, the website, jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.